The final words of the Sermon on the Mount are here in Matthew 7, verses 24 to 27. Jesus said, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it." So Jesus gives one final charge. He essentially says, "Now the sermon is preached, and it is yours to do with what you will." The old school preachers would say, "And now the sermon is yours." And that's essentially what Jesus is saying here. What you do with it is up to you. You have the ability, you have the opportunity, you have the free will to decide what you will do with these words. And so what I want us to do is look at this example and talk about the two houses, the two foundations, and what to do about it. The two houses, the two foundations, and what to do. So first, notice that what's implied in this example about these two houses is that on the surface, they look very similar. If there's anything different about the way that they appear, Jesus doesn't comment on it. I think that we're supposed to understand that from a passing glance, from anybody who might just see from the outside, that these two houses look to be identical. Both of them had to be built. Both of them took some time and some effort and even some planning. Both builders apparently had good intentions. And on the surface, it would seem that both builders had done a fine job. Both houses were finished. Both houses were livable. But the truth is, there are many different ways to build a life that look good on the surface. And they're not all equal. You can build your life on career. You can build your life on what you can accomplish with your work. You can make your entire identity about what you achieve or what you do. You might make a lot of money, and that could be the way that you build your life. You could build your life on family. You could prioritize time with your spouse and with your kids, and you could make your whole life about being there to support them in their extracurriculars and in their interests and being physically and emotionally available to them. And that could be the way that you build your life. You can build your life on a sense of nationalism or politics. You can make your whole identity about making your country great and saving it from those people who are the bad guys, whoever they are. You can build your life on religion. You can make your whole life about going to church, being in good standing with the right people, things like that. And on the surface, all of those houses might look good. From the outside looking in, all of those houses might look like they have been finely crafted out of good, solid materials. People on the outside might see people like that and say, "Those are good, upstanding people with good, upstanding lives." And some of those things might actually be good things. The point is not that none of those things matter. The point is that none of those things are sufficient for being the foundation of your life. Because none of those things are as solid as the words of Jesus. What Jesus is telling us is that the only foundation for your life, the only foundation that will last, the only foundation that will give your life strength and resiliency in times of storms, and then one day in the final judgment, is a life that is built directly on his words, on his teachings, and on his commands. And so, there are two foundations. There are only two. There are a lot of different types of sand that you might build on, but at the end of the day, it's either sand or it's rock. And in this example, the foundation of the house is revealed by testing. You notice that? It seems like the two houses look the same, that it's hard to tell the difference between the two until they're tested. It's when the rains fall and when the floods come and when the wind blows and beats on the house that the house either stands or falls. And so many times in life, that's the way it works for us. It's when we're tested that we find out what we're really made of. It's when we're tested that we reveal whether we have been built on a strong, solid foundation or whether we've just been propped up on something that's shifting beneath our feet. Look at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1. In 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter talks about this living hope that we've been born again to. And we've talked about this a few times. He talks about in verse 4 that we have an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for us. And we've talked about how that is the inheritance that Jesus wants us to set our affections on. That we wouldn't lay treasures up for ourselves on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but that we would lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal, that we would set our affections on what's eternal. But notice what Peter goes on to say in 1 Peter chapter 1 in verse 6. He says, "In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." See, what Peter recognizes about the value of trials is that trials in life can refine our faith in the same way that the fire refines the gold. Trials do to our faith what fire does to the gold. They test it. They refine it. They have a way of burning off the impurities. And so there may be times in life when you can feel that your foundation is shifting underneath you. There may be times when you realize that whatever it is that you thought you could build your life on, whatever it was that you thought was worthy of your ultimate affections, whatever it was that might bring you satisfaction or fulfillment, is failing. Maybe the thing that you built your life on is being threatened, and you feel your whole identity being threatened along with it. The trials of life help us to see what's passing away. The fiery trials are almost like a preview of the final fire. The rains are starting to fall. And if we realize that our house is built at least partially on the sand, the time to rebuild it is now before the deluge comes and we're swept away completely. See, if you have built your life on something like your career, well, then what happens if your career is taken away from you? If you've built your life on your family, then God forbid, what happens if your family is taken away from you? See, you don't just lose those things. You don't just lose the thing itself. If that's your foundation, you lose you. You pass away along with that thing. You are as strong as your foundation is. And there's only one foundation that's suitable for building your life on. That's Jesus' point. And the reason why the words of Jesus are a firm foundation to build on is because the rock is Jesus Christ himself. You know, in 1 Peter, Peter goes on to talk about that as well. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 6, he quotes from Isaiah 28, and he says that Jesus is a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. You realize that if you put your confidence in anything else, in literally anything else, you will eventually be put to shame. It'll eventually pass out from underneath your feet. The life that you have constructed for yourself will implode on itself. But Jesus said in Matthew 24, verse 35, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And so Jesus is drawing us to this decision point. He's drawing us to this decision between two choices. And like he's emphasized over and over again, there's really only two. There's two gates, there's two roads, there's two trees, there's two foundations. It's either eternity with him or certain disaster. You can either align yourself with the words of Jesus and live forever, or you can align yourself with literally anything else and pass away. So how do we do that? How do we make sure that we are building our house on the rock? What is it that Jesus is actually telling us we ought to do? Well, notice in verse 24, he says this. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them. Jesus wants us to understand that the blessing of the Sermon on the Mount doesn't come simply in the hearing, but in the doing. That if you want to enjoy the blessings that he offers, that it requires obedience on our part. If you hear the words of Jesus, but you don't obey them, then they really haven't done you any good. If you hear the teaching of Jesus and it doesn't change you, then what has it really accomplished? And when you get right down to it, disobedience is really just a lack of faith. If you really believe what Jesus says, and if you really trust what Jesus says, then you will really do what Jesus says. I think that's the point. If you're not actually doing it, if you're hearing his words without obeying them, it must mean that you either don't believe him or you don't trust him, because if you do, you will obey him. There are so many similarities between the book of James and the Sermon on the Mount, and one of those similarities is our often quoted James chapter 2 with the final words of this sermon. In James chapter 2, James is making a similar point that Jesus is making right here in the final words of the Sermon on the Mount. He says in verse 14, "What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and filled,' without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead." What James is saying here is that if you say you have faith without actually acting on it, then that's not real faith. Just like a body without the spirit is not really the person, faith without works is dead. And so you can't build your house on the rock just by thinking about it. You can't build your life on the rock just by talking about it. You have to build your life on the rock by actually building it, by actually doing the things that Jesus has been telling you to do throughout this whole sermon. So the wise man is the one who not only hears the words of Jesus and understands them, or hears these words and believes them, but the one who hears these words and does them. And I think it's important to emphasize here that Jesus is not dealing with the means of our salvation, which is grace. Salvation is a free gift. Salvation is something that God offers to people who don't deserve it. But what he's talking about here is the conditions of our salvation. He's saying God has made it freely available. God will do for you what you can't do for yourself, but God will not force it on you. The only way to receive it is by faith. The only way to actually participate in what God wants you to have in your life is by submitting to his will. That's the only way that this works. You have to hear it and obey it. You have to hear it and you have to do it. And so at the end of this sermon, Jesus is talking about people who truly understand the grace of God. People who are so enamored with the grace of God, fascinated with it, swept away by it, that they have decided to dedicate their entire lives to serving him. Not people who are trying to ask, what is the bare minimum requirement that I have to do to sneak in under the door? Not people who are trying to live with one foot in the kingdom and one foot in the world, but people who have pure hearts, affections wholly set on the kingdom of God and his righteousness. People who have been so deeply moved by what God has done for them that they realize that it demands their whole life and that nothing less is acceptable. He's not talking about perfect people, but he's talking about people who have decided that this is the foundation of who they are forever. People who see the grace of God in his commandments, not apart from them. People who value the wisdom of God in what he says to do, not in spite of it. And so Jesus is not saying that obedience merits our salvation, by no means. But he's saying that obedience is consistent with salvation. That people who are disobedient will not receive it. And so the only people who will be saved in the end are the people who trust God enough to do what he tells them to do. The final words of the sermon emphasize the tragedy of people who can hear the words of Jesus without doing them. In some ways, it captures all of the warnings throughout the sermon. It talks about the people who are hypocritical, who are content to fool others instead of actually presenting themselves in sincerity to God. It includes people who have deluded themselves, thinking that they're sheep when in fact they're goats. Verse 27 says, "The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house and it fell, and great was the fall of it." D. Bowman was a preacher who was known for saying, "If you've missed heaven, you've missed it all." And that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. There's something about boiling it down to something so simple that's so compelling. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you have accomplished in this life. It doesn't matter what you have built. It doesn't matter what you have achieved. If your house doesn't last, then you've lost everything. If you've missed heaven, you've missed it all. If the house falls, great is the fall of it. And so this is the destination of the broad path. This is the destiny of the bad trees. This is where wolves and goats alike will end up. Because disaster is the final outcome of any house not built on the words of Jesus Christ. And ultimately, that is what hell is. Hell is complete and final separation from God and his goodness. Is something that's so unthinkably awful that the words and descriptors fall short. Sometimes it's described as an outer darkness and a gnashing of teeth. Sometimes it's described as a lake of fire. It's an existence that is totally removed from the source of all goodness forever and ever. A place without joy, a place without peace, a place without goodness. But it's a reality that ultimately we choose for ourselves, if that's what we receive. It's choosing to build our houses, to build our lives on something other than the solid rock of Jesus Christ. I like the way that Tim Keller said it in his book, The Reason for God. He wrote, "A common image of hell in the Bible is that of fire. Fire disintegrates. Even in this life, we can see the kind of soul disintegration that self-centeredness creates. We know how selfishness and self-absorption leads to piercing bitterness, nauseating envy, paralyzing anxiety, paranoid thoughts, and the mental denials and distortions that accompany them." See what he's saying? There is a torture that we inflict on ourselves when we insist on making ourselves the center of the universe. But he goes on to say, now ask this question. What if when we die, we don't end, but spiritually our life extends on into eternity? In short, hell is simply one's freely chosen identity apart from God on a trajectory into infinity. See, in the short term, if you build your life on the sand, it might seem okay. You might construct a house that other people look at and they say, that's a beautiful house. They might think that you're somebody that has it together, has something impressive, has something desirable. And the reality is, the closer the trajectory of your life is to the trajectory of Jesus' words, the harder it's going to be to detect in the short term. You know, that's the way trajectory works. It's an angle that gets greater and greater the further that it goes. And so what Jesus is saying is that if you build your life on the sand, it might not be noticeable immediately, but eventually the difference is going to become strikingly clear. The testing and the trials of this life might be enough to knock you down. When you go through things in this life that are truly difficult, when you feel your whole sense of self being threatened by the things that you're facing, it should tell you that your foundation isn't where it ought to be. But if in the long term, the testing and trials of life don't reveal it, the final judgment will. And Jesus is warning us that the only rock that is suitable for a building to last forever are his words. You know, Jesus warned about hell more than anybody else in the whole Bible. And it's an uncomfortable thing to think about. It's an uncomfortable reality for us to talk about sometimes. But it would be good for us to remember why Jesus warned about it and why Jesus talked about it. It was because he wanted people to escape this fate. It was because he loved people enough to steer them away from something like this. Jesus wants to wake us up to the nature of ultimate reality, to call us to a living faith in God that saturates every fiber of our identity and our being. Jesus wants our souls to be anchored in the one who is eternal by bringing every thought, every action, every intention into submission to him. And people who do that will have a strength in this life that nothing else can give them. They'll have a stability in this life that nothing else can offer. They'll have a relationship that cannot be taken away from them. They'll have a power that cannot be brought to an end. And the trajectory of a soul like that is infinite glory. infinite peace, infinite joy. Proverbs 4 and verse 18 says, "The path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until full day." That's the path that Jesus wants us to walk. A path that grows brighter and brighter, not one that gets darker and darker. Jesus wants us to build our lives on a foundation that will only get better with time, not worse. And so Jesus invites us to build our lives on Him and His words. A path that grows brighter and brighter, on and on, forever and ever. And so with these words, Jesus finishes speaking. And the last two verses of Matthew 7 give us an impression of what the people who heard him thought. It says in verse 28 that when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. The last two verses of this chapter elevate our attention from the greatness of the sermon to the greatness of its preacher. You know, the difference between Jesus and any other preacher is that any other preacher is just a messenger. Any other preacher ought to feature the message and stand behind the message and take the attention away from him and put it on the message itself. And with Jesus, in this case, it's just the opposite. In this case, though the sermon is great, the preacher is greater still. Jesus is the message. Jesus is the Word become flesh. He himself is the fulfillment of God's eternal plan and the end of the ages. And the people who saw him correctly understood that. I thought about how in John chapter 7, the Jewish authorities were starting to get a little bit concerned about Jesus and the impact that his words were having on people. And so they sent some officers to go and arrest him, and they end up coming back empty-handed. And so the chief priest and the Pharisees, they want an explanation, and so they ask the officers, "Why did you not bring him?" And the only thing that they could say was, "No one ever spoke like this man." That's what the crowds recognized when they heard him speak on this Galilean hillside. No one ever spoke like him. They were astonished at his teaching. He taught with authority that no human messenger could ever muster. There was no speculation, there was no confusion in his voice. He didn't build his arguments based on what the scribes and rabbis had said before him. He declared to them, "Verily, verily, I say to you," with declarations of absolute fact. He attested to the truth as only the truth itself was capable. And so when you consider all of the claims that Jesus makes in this sermon, you realize that they're tremendous claims. Jesus said that he would be the one to preside over the final judgment. He said that he would be the one to separate the sheep from the goats. He would be the one to welcome some into eternal life and to tell others, "Depart from me, I never knew you." Jesus could say that our eternal destinies would be determined by each person's response to his word. And so, to understand the Sermon on the Mount, we have to understand who it was who delivered it. Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. He is the Christ. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. The truth and himself are inseparable. He is the message of God of salvation to the world. And if you remember when Peter recognized that about him in Matthew 16, Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." It was Peter's faith in Jesus as the Son of God, as God's plan of salvation for all humanity for all time. It was Jesus' confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Holy One, the Son of God, that his words are everlasting life, that Jesus said, "That's the rock. That's the rock that I will build my church on." And so the opportunity and the invitation that Jesus gives to us is ultimately this, that we would recognize his glory and build our life on his life. Recognize that when everything else passes away, it is only him and his kingdom that will stand. That he is the rock, and heaven itself is found in him. And so with that, the opportunity that we have this afternoon is to evaluate our own houses. You are the builder of your house. You are the one who decides what foundation to build on. And Jesus doesn't give some kind of irresistible demand. Instead, he finishes with a soft and tender invitation, calling the righteous, not calling the righteous, but calling the sinners to repentance.